It's no secret that I'm a big fan of the NPR extended format shows like Radiolab and This American Life. Yeah, they're lefty, Radiolab less so, but they do a great job at something that we conservatives tend to be awful at. They tell stories in an engaging way, and they spend their time to explore and explain complex topics and make them accessible to the listener. Part of that is a result of their production values. Radiolab especially is exquisitely produced, probably the best produced radio on the air today. While This American Life uses so-called live sound and musical underscoring to set the mood, Radiolab has pushed the limits of, there's really no other way to put it, illustrative sound. All of that helps to tell the story. Those are tools that I want to put to use for our side, and this is the vehicle to do it. It may vary from week to week. One week it may be an on-site interview, it may be how someone, possibly even someone you know, is being affected by a specific policy. Some weeks will be like this one, trying to take a complex idea and boil it down to its essence. Now, one word about the format. There's a reason that those shows have multiple hosts, multiple producers, multiple reporters. This is a lot of work. So we're going to try about 10 minutes a week and see where it leads. I really want to thank Stacy Petty for giving me the chance to do this, and the venue to do it in, even though it's a little different from what you're used to hearing on talk radio. I hope you like the product, and I hope you learn something from it as well. If you've spent any time at all listening on Mondays over the last year, you know that one of the topics I talk a lot about is PARA, our state's public pensions. And you also know that as of right now, as we speak, PARA admits to having made about $25 billion, that's billion with a B, $25 billion more in promises than it has the money on hand to meet. If you do the accounting right, and that dispute really is for another day, there are those who think that number should be closer to $100 billion. If you figure there are about 2 million households in Colorado, that comes out to about $50,000 per household. Like a credit card or some other debt, nobody can come around and call that in, but it's still on the books. If you think of it as a mortgage, it's basically the same thing as adding the cost of a really nice kitchen remodel to your mortgage balance, only you don't get the kitchen. And this is bad. It's bad for taxpayers, it's bad for communities who over time are finding it hard to pay for other things like schools and libraries and roads. And it's bad for the retirees and the future retirees who are making decisions based on promises that might not be kept. This has been a matter of concern to the state legislature for well over a decade now, but it's been a matter of acute concern for the last 7 or 8 years. And 5 years ago, the state passed Senate Bill 1, or SB1, if you want to sound like the cool kids, which was a significant overhaul of how PARA worked in an attempt to get this under control. One of the problems, though, is that we don't really have a very good idea of how to measure whether or not it is under control. We don't have a very good early warning system to let us know if we're storing up more trouble. So last year, 2014, the legislature passed another law tasking the state auditor to produce some better measures of how PARA is doing. We know we're at about 60% funding, but can we do better? Can we come up with something that gives us a better idea of where we are and where we're going? The purpose of this podcast is to describe what that better way might be. My wife and I recently took a trip to Alaska. And since I used to have a private pilot's license, I took a flight-seeing flight over a section of Denali with lots of mountains and glaciers. Alaska is different in that all flying up there is visual flight rules, meaning that, unlike down here, you need to be able to see where you're going all the time. That's because, as the pilot put it, our clouds are seeded with granite. Now imagine that you're in one of those planes, and instead of simply a flight-seeing flight, you're going into the interior. You need to be able to clear the mountains up front, be able to gain enough altitude so that you don't crash into them.
That's the 5832 Juliet Fresno Tower, runway 29 left, clear for takeoff.
29 left, clear for takeoff, 32 Juliet.
Come on, 70, leave a contact.
Now suppose that instead of flying a real plane, the plane you're flying is PARA. Basically, what we're asking the state auditor to do is to tell us when we're getting into a situation where we might not clear those mountains and we have to do something about it. Right now, today, basically, we have two measures. We have the absolute altitude, meaning the funding level, that's the 60% number that I measured before. And it means that if we need to clear a 15,000-foot mountain, right now we're at about 9,000 feet. The other measure is how fast we're gaining altitude along a nice, smooth, average flight path. If we're at 9,000 feet now, and we'll clear the summit by, 2,000 feet when we get there, that's all right as well. If we don't, we'll go plowing into the side of the mountain, and we'll never get to that nice lakeside cabin retreat. But here's the thing. You're never going to get a nice, steady rate of return. Most of the time, that's okay. Turbulence generally doesn't throw you out of the sky. You just get bounced around, and the general rate of climb stays the same. But if you get caught in a downdraft, or if you get caught in a microburst, you may never be able to make that up. So even if you're setting the plane to climb at the right rate, you might still hit the side of the mountain. What's more, just as a mountain isn't a wall, the liability isn't a lump sum payment in 30 years. You're constantly making this year's payments, which is kind of like the ground rising underneath you. You may have picked up plenty of altitude and be far from the mountain, but it may not be high enough off the ground to keep that microburst from slamming you into the ground. And then there are all those things you can control, like underpaying, which is like not giving enough fuel, or trying to get out of that by chasing riskier and riskier investments, which is like pointing the nose higher, and having a fire sale on purchase service credit, which is like calling in a construction crew to raise the mountain, all of which makes you more vulnerable to turbulence, making it more likely that you'll crash before you even get there. The problem is that in the investment world, adding return by trying to climb higher by pointing the nose up actually adds turbulence, adds risk. Para's current dashboard basically has one number. Do we have enough to get us over the mountain and if everything goes smoothly as planned? As we've seen, things never go smoothly as planned. Para relies on long-term returns being stable, and that's true to some extent. Over any 30-year period since the inception of the S&P 500 in 1928, returns have never averaged less than 8%. But in that same time, there have been 5 years where it's been down 20% or more, enough to drive you right into the turf. That includes the dot-com bubble burst and the mortgage meltdown. Both happened in the last 15 years. Sometimes you do really well, sometimes you do really poorly, and most of the time you come out somewhere in the middle. The likelihood of each of these things happening is called the distribution. And you can treat it like you would a roulette wheel or a pair of dice. From spin to spin or roll to roll or year to year, you never know what the results will be, even though they're predictable over a long period of time. So what if we did this? What if, instead of coming up with an average and calling it a model, we looked at how Para had its money invested and created the equivalent of an electronic roulette wheel for those investments? Such models are used all the time in investing. They're called Monte Carlo simulations.
Marquons les jeux, mesdames et messieurs. Les jeux sont faits. La partie continue. Marquons les jeux. Fini. 22. Noir pair et passe. 22.
Here's how they work. We run the same Para flight plan over and over again and model what the investment might look like over the next 30 years using the same set of investments tens or even hundreds of thousands of times. Sometimes the weather's good and we make it over the mountain. Sometimes, not so much. We count up the number of times we make it and the number of times we don't, and we come up with a number that says, here's how likely we are to crash and burn sometime in the next 30 years. If that number is, say, 5%, meaning there's a 1 in 20 chance Para would need a bailout, I think most of us could live with that level of risk. But if that number starts to creep up to, say, 10 or 15%, 15% meaning basically a 1 in 6 chance that you're going to have to bail Para out, people are going to start to get nervous. So far, Para's resisted this sort of modeling. For one thing, it's hard to do. The formulas that describe how well different investments will do can be complicated. And there's also the chance that people might not like what they see. After all, if Para's been telling retirees that things will work out for the best, and then they find out there's a 20 or 25% chance that we're going to find ourselves in a crisis sometime in their golden years, they might start to look at Para as less than a sure thing. The math isn't impossible to do. A 2010 paper by Andrew Biggs of the American Enterprise Institute did just this for dozens of public pensions all over the country. Prior to the 2010 returns, Biggs estimated that Para had about a 5% chance of surviving the next 30 years. That's prior to the 2010 reforms. A similar study hasn't been done since then. But it's this sort of measure that quantifies risk in a way that most people can understand and that actually tells you something about how well we're doing.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come on and fly with me.